morning, everyone. Let us please pray together. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master, Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on a throne of my consciousness. I'd read to you a short email that I received from Angela Victory. Good evening, David and Carla. We're packing tonight for our camping trip to Vancouver Island. We have booked four nights and are really excited and spend loads of time together in the great outdoors. I was reading Aiden a story tonight, and the book was about God. The little girl asks her mom where God lives. Mother replies, in heaven. I got an instant correction. Nope, he doesn't live in heaven. He lives in your forehead, as Aiden pointed strongly and intently to his third eye. Angela's commentary, correct. Isn't that lovely? We have some tremendous souls who have been coming into the world recently. And this is a wonderful time. In the Chinese tradition, there is a time in which there is great opportunity, but there is also great danger. And we face such times. We've come through many difficult times in this transition between the Kali Yuga, the age of darkness, and the Dwapara Yuga. Now you may look around and you may see many reasons to think that we're still in the Kali Yuga. We have much advancements in terms of technology, in terms of the conveniences that we have. There are many wonderful things that have been developed. Also many powerful things, and some of those powerful things are weapons and ways of destroying each other. And so we come at a crossroads with the development of such technology, such ingenuity of the human mind. We also must keep in mind that wisdom must keep pace with ingenuity. If it does not do so, it throws everything out of balance. We cannot just continue to develop the mind without also developing the spirit. It is in the spirit that we gain the real balance that keeps us from going off the edge of the cliff. We're not completely out of the woods. We have great things afoot. And it is really a calling upon each one of us to develop ourselves, not just materially, although that is all right as well, and not just technologically, although that is also all right. But what is most importantly needed is that we develop ourselves spiritually. Without it, this world can self-destruct and destroy humanity's potential for reaching for the heavens, for reaching for the stars, for reaching for things that are higher and greater. Sometimes I look out on this world with some despair, because I see that people live for a type of freedom, a freedom only, though, of the senses, a freedom that the ego can do what the ego wants to do, and without any thought of consequences. What are the results of the things that we do? There are no free lunches, so to speak, from the field of economics. Everything must be paid for, and that is not just true in a money standpoint, but everything that we do. And in truth, we should look at what is the right thing to do. In yoga in India, this is called dharma. Dharma is initially a set of rules. It is like and is the same as the Ten Commandments. And the set of rules are a prescription of what to do and what not to do. Patanjali calls those the yamas and the niyamas. And those things that we should do, we should adhere to, and those things that we should not do, we should stay away from. And these are the tests that come to us. This is what you might say is the outer dharma, the outer dharma. But the inner dharma, the inborn dharma, is that which awakens inside of you, which knows the truth. Now you have to go beyond the mind. You have to go beyond all the different ways that you have been taught in this world to come to a complete standstill within the mind in order to reveal a deeper knowing, a deeper spirit, not something of the mind alone, that which reasons, but the intuitive mind, the mind that goes beyond reason. And when you come into that complete state of standstill of the human mind, it becomes mirror-like, and it mirrors that which is above it. It mirrors the heavenly consciousness. And you enter there at the third eye point, at the point in the middle of the forehead, as Aidan so wisely pointed out. That is the place of the kingdom of heaven. That is the place where you will find God. Now, when we say God, we don't mean a personage. We don't mean an individual who lives in some antiseptically clean part of the universe. God is something tremendous, something beyond description, really, and yet we try to find ways to describe that which is indescribable. God is the intelligence that has gone into creating this entire world, this entire universe. Now, when we look about us, and we see the intelligence of nature, it's really quite something. A scientist can take as his field of study a particular aspect of creation and can spend his entire life delving into the deeper secrets of that aspect of creation and never get to the bottom of it. It only seems that one thing leads to another. And you look at the intelligence that goes into a tree, for instance, and the photosynthesis that allows it to produce its food, the great pumping action. I once read where a great fir tree will pump 600 gallons of water a day for its own needs. That's tremendous. And it brings it up through the trunk and into the limbs and out through the leaves, and there it can produce its food along with sunlight and the minerals and nutrients that it draws from the soil. We look at the bark that's protective. And we look at all the different aspects, all the cells that make up that tree. And it's a tremendous thing. Go out and try to design one. Design all the things that go into making a tree work and function and have its life. But that's not even the biggest story, its design. Then you would actually have to give it life. And where would that life come from? Where does your life come from when the spermatozoa and the ovum come together and form one seed? And then that seed divides. And it goes on, and it develops an entire human body. Where does that life impulse come from? Sometimes it's imagined, we've been told, that some spark of lightning comes down into some protozoa soup, and life was created. But really, that doesn't explain it. The intelligence, the life that goes into this creation is tremendous. And yet, we live in this world unquestioningly. We really don't wonder about these things. We don't ask the deeper questions. We don't go beyond the surface of things. We seem satisfied with what we're given, as if that is the answer that we're really needing to find. The truth is so tremendous. And the greatest truth among truths is that we might realize the source of life. Now, to some, that may seem a fantasy. But I can tell you, through my own experiments within the laboratory of my own soul and my own being, that these truths will reveal themselves to you. And when they do, they take you beyond yourself. They take you beyond everything that you have known or read. Brand new information comes to you. And it just doesn't come as an idea, but it comes as a revelation. A revelation is different than a singular idea. A singular idea, we get an inspiration, perhaps. We're working on a project. We're trying to figure something out. And then suddenly a bright idea, a light bulb moment, dawns on us. And we get it. We get the answer that we were looking for, and suddenly something works that didn't work before. And that's a wonderful thing, and it's a mysterious thing all in its own right. Who thought of the idea? Where did that idea come from? It's really quite amazing. But a revelation comes on a deeper level. When you get a revelation, it's not just an idea. It's an entire experience that you have. It embodies every part of you. You stand in awe of what you experience because it entails the feeling, the idea, and you go beyond yourself. You penetrate into the very source of the intelligence that has given you this. And as I say, it is trying to describe the indescribable. But you must know that such a revelation comes from a much, much more profound place than that idea moment that you got that was a solution to a particular problem. That is a small manifestation of what you can experience right within yourself. Now, we have many people who proclaim that God told me this and God told me that. There's once a television preacher that said if somebody didn't give so many millions in donations that God was going to call him home. And I would say it's probably time for him to go to such a home. That's the case. That's a complete and total misuse of the idea of revelation of God. We must be profound spiritual scientists. We cannot play fast and loose with things. We cannot play with them as if for our own convenience and what we want to have happen. We must be serious about this. And when people play fast and loose with such things, they hurt the faith that people must have in order to delve deeper. They start to write it all off as if it means nothing. Now, we can look at many examples in many fields where people have misused that field of study for their own purposes. They've distorted things. They've deleted things. They've taken things to a level that were never meant to be. And because the idea of God and religion is so powerful, it is perhaps more ripe with intrigue and duplicity than other fields are, because it is so powerful. But this does not discount the idea that at the root of all, there is something essential, that is something very, very important to our nature and the nature of mankind and the nature of this entire creation. We are marvelous beings, we human beings. We have a special creation. And that doesn't mean that we have more importance necessarily than any other aspect of creation. What it means is we were specially endowed with the ability to perceive the divine creator. We have certain spots here at the ajna, the point between the eyebrows, here at the sahasrara, at the top of the head, here at the medulla oblongata, as Master pointed out, is the doorway to God. And these are unique to mankind in that we're able to have those open up. Now, the fact that there are very, very few who take advantage of these great gifts doesn't mean that they don't exist, and they exist in everyone. But if you don't take advantage of it, then you won't be able to perceive it. To somebody who has had no spiritual experience at all, no God experience, and there are some who do not, this remains a complete mystery. It remains a mental kind of thing. Well, it's a nice idea, or it's your idea, but I don't have any real experience with it, so what do you expect of me? And the fact is that we all have to use the tools that we have been given, that we have been granted. If we have some interest in the area, if we have some notion, well, perhaps there is something greater, then we can speed our evolution. We can make conscious progress towards realization. But this doesn't mean accepting an idea, an ideal, or a philosophy just because somebody else said it. It means going into the laboratory of our own being and really getting to work. It's not easy to quiet this mind. We're in such a habit of constantly going and going and going. And we don't slow down. We don't come to a still state. And the first thing that may occur to us, well, what a waste of time, just sitting there thinking of nothing. I've got things to do, places to go, people to see. But it's the truth. And when the truth is spoken, it has power to it. And it should awaken something deep inside of us. And if it occurs to us that there is something perhaps to all of this, then we can pursue it. And we can begin to bring it out. Not just echoing or parroting what somebody else says, but really going in, diving deep. And this is true for all of us. Until we have our total and complete realization, we should not speak of things that we have not yet realized. Make a difference between those things that you believe in and those things that you have realized. Because there is a vast, vast difference. One is an intellectual conception. The other is a direct perception of truth. And when that comes, it changes your life. This is a beautiful, this is a wonderful thing. But we should not treat it lightly. We have been given a great gift. And as with all great gifts that are given, there is a responsibility. We as the receivers then must see to it that we are capable of receiving the gift and that we take that gift and we do something with it. We do something with it. I would like to read from chapter 13 from the Bhagavad Gita. I shall now declare unto thee, O best of Bharatas, Arjuna, the path, traversing which at the time of death yogis attain freedom, and also the path wherein there is rebirth. Fire, light, daytime, the bright half of the lunar month, the 6 months of the northern course of the sun, pursuing this path at the time of departure, knowers of God, go to God. Smoke, nighttime, the dark half of the lunar month, the 6 months of the southern course of the sun. He who follows this path obtains only lunar light and thus returns to earth. These two paths for existing, for exiting the world, are reckoned eternal. The way of light leads to release. The way of darkness leads to rebirth. Master's Commentary. These mysterious stanzas, woefully misinterpreted by nearly all commentators, in reality, certain symbolic references to the science of yoga. They describe the opening of the spiritual eye and the awakening of the cerebral spinal centers and the ascension of the life force and consciousness through them to cosmic consciousness and liberation in spirit of the yogi who follows the way of light. And on the contrary, they describe also the descension or return to body consciousness or rebirth of those yet unable to open fully all the cerebral spinal doors that lead ultimately to spirit. Liberation, freeing the soul from the physical, astral, and causal bodies, is the purport of these verses. The ponderous scriptures of the rishis have defined in veiled terms the labyrinth of the soul's descension and ascension. Krishna has here stated this portion of the yoga science succinctly for the comprehending Arjuna, the advanced yogi devotee. The rudiments are as follows. Stanza 24 states that the yogi who attains liberation must follow the path of fire. Here, fire means life energy, the kundalini power. The devotee's first scientific step towards emancipation is to gain control of his life force. In ordinary man, the course of prana is downward, the way of darkness, flowing from the brain to the sensory nerves and the countless cells of the body. This dispersion and diffusion of life energy reveal to human consciousness the material world. In the successful yogi, on the other hand, the course of prana is upward, the way of light. By yoga, he reverses the direction of the flow and is able to concentrate the whole of his life force within the brain, in the sun of cosmic consciousness. In this way, God is revealed. The sun of cosmic consciousness is the supreme source of life and intelligence in the body, with its abode in the seventh or the highest spiritual center, in the cerebrum, in the thousand-petaled lotus, a sunburst as a thousand suns. All life and faculties of the body evolve from this powerhouse of luminosity through its projected rays of the spiritual eye. This is a wonderful elucidation of these verses. We all follow either a way of darkness or a way of light. Really, there is no in between. While we can lead a good life in this world, unless we transcend this world, we are not really living a life of light. When we start on this spiritual journey, we start at the base of the spine, and the base of the spine is a repository of this tremendous kundalini power. It is picturesquely described as a coiled-up serpent. Now, in the story of Adam and Eve, we know that the serpent descended down the tree and was a temptation to Eve. Eve represents feeling. And Eve then tempted Adam. Adam represents reason. And so feeling and reason together then are seduced by this downward pointing snake. And it points to the center of the garden, and the center of the garden are the sexual nerves. Now, sexuality is something that is given to us as human beings for the reproduction of this race. And it is a good thing. It is a wonderful thing. It is something to be known and to be understood. When we are ready, we can learn to internalize the mind and draw the life force up the spine. This is the way of light. And when you do this successfully, this kundalini force coiled at the base of the spine now streams upwards. It flows up through the spine and it goes to the higher centers. Now, in the meantime, as we are working to free this force from going all the way up to the spine, every one of the spiritual centers going up the spine have a dual nature to it. There is a positive and a negative. So at the very base of the spine, which represents our own ability to survive, to live within this body, and all the body functions that go along with that, there's a positive life-affirming aspect to that. And when we reach up for more life, it positively gravitates towards that. But there's the part of us that is attached to this body. And so a great fear comes up. And it comes all over us. And it's a fear of death. It's a fear of the end of this world. And when we come into this, it can just really dominate us with everything that we have. During my own journey in this upward progress, I would sit down for meditation and I would have a vision. And in this vision, I would see a nuclear explosion going off over Elliott Bay in downtown Seattle. And my point of view was high above the city. And I would see this missile coming in and then I would see this tremendous explosion in light. And at first it was pure terror that would come over me. Now, this was all happening while I was supposed to be sitting in meditation and getting peace and a little preparation for the day to keep me going. And so it's not what we expect. It's not what we think is going to happen. But there it is. And we have to deal with it because this is that polarity that is occurring at each one of the chakras. And we have to work through these things as they come along. We have to stay on the field. We have to keep at it, even though it can be terrifying in the moment. Now, this is something that produces real freedom, because when we overcome the fears, our instinct for preserving this life in this body, then we attain a much greater freedom than we've ever had before. And then we come to the next center, which is the sexual center and the center for the senses. It awakens inside of us. And here we experience the temptation of going out and having all the life force go out through the sexual nerves. And it's really tremendous. This happened for Mother when she was at Anandashram. And when she was starting to go through these experiences. And at this time, it is best to keep the seed within the human body because this is the power that will lift you up into higher divine consciousness. And so as you retain this seed within you, this power, this life energy, then you go beyond that and then you come to the realm of powers in the third chakra. This is individual willpower. And this is the place where powers tempt you. And it's really a temptation when you think of all the good that you could do if you had miraculous powers, if you had powers of magnetism, personal magnetism, and all the rest of it, then this would be a real temptation that comes to you. Because you oftentimes think of all the good. Now, there are negative souls who just think purely selfishly is what they can do. But you think what the good you can do if you're a good soul and all the things that you can do. This is picturesquely described when Jesus is taken up by the devil and shown that he can have power over the entire world if he would just bow down and worship Satan, which is that oppositional force. And Jesus refuses him. He knows what his real journey is. He knows that this is a dead end. Perhaps there have been other lifetimes where he has experienced this. Now, we have different souls who follow along on this path, who sometimes have a great fear around psychic powers and phenomena, because in past lives, they have really made some major mistakes. And sometimes, those things carry on with you. You have psychic experiences. You have experiences with ghosts or other kinds of beings that are many times dark and negative, or they're offering you tremendous things. And as Krishna says in the Gita, and as oftentimes described by Mother and all the great yogis, is that these must be strictly avoided because they are such a strong temptation. And they come to you and they're real. But you have to put them aside. Master himself described that when he came to America, he sometimes used powers. But there came a point where he very definitely set them aside. He told Divine Mother, "Take these away. I don't want them." Because he knew and he sensed within himself what a temptation they could be, and that he had to go beyond it all. And so this happens at the third chakra. And then you make the transition to the fourth. Now the fourth is where the mystical transformation really begins, because you go beyond your own personal narrow identification. And it is in the heart center that you first open yourself up to greater and greater sense of expansion of the circle of your being. It happens in the heart, and it happens essentially through love. With love, you go beyond your own narrow personal considerations. You go beyond just what's in it for you. Love, when it is God's love, has nothing to do with personality. It's not because somebody treats you the way you like to be treated, or compliments you, or makes you feel good. It's not anything like that at all. It is a pure state of being. And when you go into divine love, you have a love that is universal. It is for all beings, all creation. Everything that exists vibrates to that tune of love. And when you feel that and you know it, you can't narrowly define yourself any longer. When you look out on the people who are around you, you don't see them as separate from yourself, but you see them as your very self. It is an intuitive comprehension that you have at that moment. And you no longer live in a field of separation. Your circle of identification goes out and out and out. And this is the way that divine consciousness looks at us. This is the way that God looks at us. God does not look at us as separate from himself, but God sees us as his very self, for that is the truth. It is he who has become ourselves. And in our spiritual completion, in our spiritual journey, we become merged into God. It is the ultimate love affair. It is not something of a sexual nature or a personal nature. It is something that transcends both of those things. It is ultimately pure. It is ultimately filled with light. When we feel this kind of love, when we feel this kind of expansion of consciousness, we are no longer identified with the little sense of I and mine and me. Those definitions, those ideas just simply drop off as the fruition of a nut or a fruit drops off at the time when it's truly ripened. It just falls from the tree. And we release ourselves into such a tremendous experience that goes beyond everything that we had known before that time. And now we merge ourselves in that infinite being. But that's not the end of our journey. For then we rise up to the sixth center, at the Ajna. And it's there that we merge into the light, the great eternal light of being. You know, all the mystical traditions talk about God as being up, God as being light. And sometimes people have thought, well, perhaps God is up in the sky. The sun is up in the sky, there's the light. God is up there someplace in heaven. Perhaps the astronauts will discover him if they go out into space far enough. But you see, this is all a mistranslation of what happens inside of us. Because we go up, but it is up the spine. And we go through, but it is through this ajna. And when we do that, that is the doorway to infinite consciousness. I had a wonderful experience of this one time. It was one of the first experiences I had of it in such a way. We had been returning from Vancouver Island. We were getting on to the ferry. Somebody else was driving. And I was taken quite spontaneously into this experience. And I was taken to the ajna, that third eye point, the point between the eyebrows. My whole attention was there. And as if a doorway of light opened. And I felt my entire consciousness go out into a sea of light. All I could see is light expanding out in all directions. And I felt myself expanding out with it. I no longer had a body, a physical body. I no longer was defined by any circumference of thought. I was pure consciousness. And that went out and out and out. I say out, but I'm only trying to describe what is essentially indescribable. And with that experience came a profound knowingness that I am not this body, that this field of light that I was entering into, that I merged into, was not a beginning nor an end. It had always existed, and it will always exist, that this human body had come into life. There will be a time when this human body will dissolve back into the earth again. But that consciousness always existed, and with that comes a profound knowledge that you and I and all of us are eternal beings. Not relegated to time and space, governed by this world and by this body. But we have an eternal nature. And it is the truth. It is the truth not only for me, not only for a few, but for all. And when we realize this truth, we gain freedom. Freedom from fear of death. Freedom from fear of limitation. Freedom from fear that we are separated. This is union that we discover. And that is the meaning of yoga, is union. And that is the coming back together once again. Now, over these past 2 months, I've had a different aspect of this fire. It's been quite interesting. And my entire being, my body, the cells of my being, have been aflame with a kind of fire. Fire is purifying in a spiritual sense. And when we have this fire, when this kundalini comes up and creates fire, it is creating a pathway. It is getting rid of the dross. It is getting rid of the things that block us from moving into the eternal sense of ourselves. But fire can also be a universal force. There is a statue up here of Shiva standing in a circle of fire. And it is the best description for what I have been experiencing over these past months. It's been a circle of fire. And it is a purifying agent. It's not anything that I've been doing myself. It's something that's been occurring through me. It's been a tremendous experience. And with this fire, all the world can be transformed. This wonderful fire, this purifying agent, can gain a grip in you and can purify you from stem to stern. Now, it's not always easy, these experiences. In fact, many of them test you all the way and can be quite difficult. But it is all extremely worthwhile. This is a day of freedom that is celebrated here in the United States, the 4th of July. I think that those early founders were truly inspired. The kind of universal truths that they spoke about, that man has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, are tremendous things that no individual should reign over us with absolute power. And that we should be able to pursue happiness. We should be able to do the things that we feel right to do. And that will ultimately result in our own individual freedom. There is no greater freedom in this world than the freedom of spirit. People imagine that doing whatever they like to do, in a human sense, gives them freedom. But we look around us and we see so oftentimes that's not true. If somebody takes on alcohol, for instance, to the point where they become an alcoholic, they are no longer free. If somebody uses drugs in the same kind of manner, they are not free. There are so many ways that we pursue freedom in this world and through this body that results in bondage, not freedom. When we take a stand in this world to do the right thing, it can be difficult at first. We know that through meditation. Oftentimes, meditation can be a real trial, can be a real struggle. But that the after effect of that meditation is we feel good. We feel uplifted. While the meditation itself may have been a struggle the entire way through, we feel better for having done it. And this is a great truth. There is a saying that is said by somebody, when you're faced with two choices, always do the one that's harder. It's usually the right one. Now, this can be a bit dismaying to us because we'd like to choose the one that's easier. But think about it. What is the after effect of what you do? If you have a piece of chocolate after dinner and that feels good and it tastes good and it's just right, and oh, there's another piece of chocolate there and wouldn't that be nice to have? And so you reach for that, and as soon as you've eaten it, you regret it. And now you feel over full and your tummy hurts a little bit and you really rue the day that you ever made that decision. That didn't lead to more freedom. It led to an imprisonment within your body consciousness in an unpleasant way. And so part of real maturity comes when we looked at what is the after effect of doing something. We have a feeling we want to do something. I'm afraid it's all too often the case today that people feel free to split up families, for mothers and fathers to divorce and of young children or growing children. But the consequences of these actions oftentimes are catastrophic for the children and everybody concerned. It seems like the easy thing to do in the moment. But the after effect has lots of ramifications to it. And many of them are unpleasant. We need to think deeply about our life. We need to consider, what are the consequences? Will this lead to my freedom, really? Or is this just an act of convenience in the moment? We need courage in order to grow. We need courage in order to thrive. We need to make the right decisions. And when we do, it may be harder up front, but what comes afterwards is a kind of interest, a kind of revenue that keeps coming to us because we have invested well. We may have done the harder thing, but it keeps coming back to us that it was the right thing. And that rightness supports the light within us. We become beings of light. To live in a circle of fire means you live on the battlefield, means you strive to do the right thing. Whether it's the Dharma that has been taught to us or it is the inborn Dharma that is being revealed to us. To strive to pierce that third eye point and go into the ajna and go beyond is a gift, a great gift. And if we can have that in our lives, we will really proclaim a freedom that will supersede all other thoughts of freedom that have been conceived down through history. It will be the greatest day of freedom this world will have ever known, because you will have achieved your freedom in spirit. And as Jesus said, "And if I be lifted up, will lift up all beings with me." So your enlightenment is not for you only, but as for the world as well. Will you please pray with me? O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging through every cell of my being. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee, I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. I bow to the light within you.